Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
Is it possible for the NFL to affect American politics? Well, our guest today, author Jesse Barrett, thinks so. In fact, he wrote a book about it called Pigskin Nation, and we'll talk about him and his book coming up in just a moment. This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. This is your host, Darren Hayes, and we're podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron, one day at a time. So with Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff supplying us with the tunes, let's go no huddle through today's football history headlines.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and welcome to the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a special episode where we are going to talk about an author who wrote a book. And today we have author Jesse Barrett, and Mr. Barrett has written a very interesting book called Pigskin Nation, How the NFL Remade American Politics. We will get into what that means in just a moment. And Jesse is not only a football historian, but he has a PhD in the subject of history from the University of California, Berkeley. His bio in his book shares that besides writing books, he has worked as a rock critic, television columnist, a reviewer of books, and a high school history teacher. We're excited to talk about NFL history and politics with Mr. B. So let's bring him into our podcast arena. Jesse Barrett, welcome to the Pigpen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, we're really happy to have you here. This is an exciting book, which we'll get to in a second. But you really piqued my interest. I'm sure that of the listeners too. I mean, how does one go from being a rock critic and television columnist to writing a book about football?
I mean, honestly, those were kind of part-time side jobs I had while I was in, basically I was in grad school and I was sort of doing other stuff. I wouldn't say I had to pay the rent because I never made enough money doing those to pay the rent. You know, I think for me, it was sort of helpful just in trying to think about different things and how to write about it. You know, and thinking about TV and sort of how TV appeals to people and how music appeals to people. Because one of the things I wanted to do in the book was kind of cross different things and just, you know, talk about football as football, but also talk about it in political terms and literary terms. I have a little tiny bit about music, I think, just about like Merle Haggard, you know, not a lot. You know, I read novels on football based in that period. So I think for me, it was just, you know, my big thing was I was trying to get a job teaching and I'm still, you know, I still teach high school. So those were sort of things I did on the side. And I guess it's part of my larger, you know, trying to understand American history and like teach it in ways that are maybe not the standard ways. And I think that's sort of, it's part of that larger way I try to do that.
Okay. So sort of what made you a sort of Renaissance man was sort of that whole feeling of history. And you just wanted to dive into anything history you really could coming out of grad school and some of the rock and roll history and which, you know, we all like that, you know, who doesn't, you know, television history. That's a great thing too. And getting into our favorite topic, football history, I guess that's a natural progression to get into and, you know, teaching the kids history. Now, what courses of study do you teach in the kids history and American history?
I teach U.S. history. That's what I was like, went to school in and I got hired for, and I teach freshman world history and I do some Middle East stuff. And I'm actually going to teach a class next year for the first time, which is on sports as a social issue. So I'm going to bring in, you know, some of this stuff and kind of talk about this globally, talk about football, talk about, you know, baseball, basketball, what the rest of the world calls football, because there's so much interesting history, I think, just to be kind of thought about in those areas. I think that's, you know, that's one thing that I just really find fascinating is how, you know, all these major political, cultural, social issues get reflected and refracted through what happens on the field, what happens off the field to kind of make what happens on the field possible. So this actually is the first time I think I'm probably really teaching it, teaching this book explicitly or teaching part of it. It always feels a little icky to like assign the book. So I don't think I'm going to do that. you know, which would be a surefire moneymaker for me.
All right.
But, you know, it just, it feels icky. So I think I'll make it an optional thing that the kids could read. But so it's actually, this isn't really like what I do in my day job. It's more a kind of, you know, maybe we'll bring in things a couple of times. Like one of the fun things I turned up was, you know, you talk about the early 20th century, which is the progressive period, and there's the growth of regulation. And I have all these stories now about the creation of the NCAA and, you know, tramp athletes and the number of people who died playing football, you know, just, and so every year there's a couple kids who will do papers on things like, because I do research papers every year. And so I'll have a kid do a paper on, you know, Title IX or regulation. One of them actually, and a bunch of them have done NCAA eligibility. So we can talk about things like amateurism and the whole concept, you know, what a weird concept that is and how, you know, college football was such a bigger deal than pro football really until probably the 50s. I mean, that's sort of what I get into in my book, you know, is this, is just how culturally dominant college football was. I think really until TV and probably till, you know, the famous greatest game ever played, that Giants Colts game in 58, where the Colts score in overtime and win, you know, and that Unitas has those two famous drives. So, you know, it's just, it's sort of been a neat sidelight just to be able to say, you know, and this is, you know, when you think about sports now to tell the students, you know, because a lot of them, I mean, I have to say it's interesting, you know, a lot of them have play fantasy football. There's always a thing every year when some kid who loses has to do some embarrassing thing, you know, from his league and from the whole school. You know, March Madness is huge. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them, interestingly, are Premier League fans now, which is surprising because just when I started 20 years ago, it wasn't a thing. And now huge numbers of kids, and you'll see them at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and they're watching whoever, Liverpool play Man United, which is just, it's an interesting change, you know, that it felt like, I mean, it's a small high school. They don't have a football team. So it, you know, there's no culture at the school of, you know, I mean, I went to public school, I went to Michigan for college. So those, you know, we had football teams and I kind of knew the whole culture of having a football team, right. But it's just interesting that when kids say football team for here, I mean, I think they say soccer, you know, that they're not, it'd be really pretentious in America to call it football, you know, because we know what football is in America and it's football. And, you know, but for kids, it's just really interesting that this is more of their thing now is European soccer, which is just an interesting change I've noticed.
Yeah, well, those are some lucky kids to be able to have some classes like that. And the one you're going to be teaching, you know, bringing a little bit of football into the school, you know, you don't have a football team, but just to do some research papers on it, that would have been a dream of mine if we could have done that when I was in school. But you sort of alluded to it a little bit, but I loved how the way you sort of did your introduction to the book with explaining the facts and the quotes of famous people of sort of the changing of the guard, so to speak, as pro football surpassed college football, like you said, and also Major League Baseball is America's favorite sport, you know, starting off with that 1958 NFL championship game. I think you're not the only one. I've had a lot of authors sort of say that's sort of the when the pendulum started swinging was that game. And you talk a lot about, you know, television and its impact. And maybe if you could, you know, sort of set the stage for the book, like you do in your introduction with those things in mind.
Okay, sure. And thank you for saying that. Yeah, I think basically the way I spent so much time trying to figure out how to organize the thing. Mm-hmm. I have, you know, I kept all my records. So I have like five different tables of contents just because I was constantly, you know, I didn't know how to put the story together. And what I finally ended up with was looking in the first half at how the NFL merchandised itself. And so the first half of the book is looking at the things that the NFL made itself, especially the books. I think it's a thing that people haven't looked at very much, you know, and the books I thought, I mean, cause I grew up on, you know, This Week in Baseball and all that kind of official stuff, you know, and it wasn't great, but when I was 10 years old, you know, I loved it because it was kind of a simple story. And so I kind of expected when the NFL, you know, produced books, they produced one famously in 1969 for the 50th year of the NFL, you know, to commemorate that. I kind of thought it would be some kind of cruddy, right, official league production. And it was actually neat to think that they actually were pretty good. Like they were interesting and complicated. And so the first half is looking at what the NFL produced to kind of sell itself to people and then how the NFL appeared on TV, starting with things like The Violent World of Sam Huff, which I really got into. It's this famous documentary TV episode from 1960 that is kind of the first up close and personal, you know, it's sort of the forerunner of shows like Hard Knocks, all those kinds of things where you get, you know, he broke, I think Sam Huff. So it basically follows Sam Huff, who's the Giants middle linebacker, And he broke something like 8 tape kits during the filming just because, you know, he kept running into people and because he played middle linebacker, right? And that was his job, you know, and it's actually really interesting because it's very unvarnished. There's a lot of fighting, you know, there's a lot of yelling. There's some interesting stories people tell about, even in 1960, guys on the New York Giants were really aware that they could kind of brand themselves on TV, you know. And so Frank Gifford's autobiography talks about, and I found a bunch of articles about this, that people kind of basically resented Sam Huff and thought that he kind of would run into plays at the end and dive on the pile because, you know, he wanted to be famous and everyone was like, oh, there goes Sam Huff. He's an amazing middle linebacker. And so, you know, there's this kind of discussion that like people who didn't know anything about football thought Sam Huff was a good football player because they'd seen him on TV. And so he kind of played to the cameras and there was this kind of resentment. So it's really interesting just to kind of follow that story. And then through obviously the creation of NFL films, and there, you know, I mean, there's scholars like Travis Vogan who've written whole books on this. So I was more kind of just trying to carve out a little bit there about how the NFL put itself on video. And then the third part of the first part is just how the NFL kind of got itself involved a little bit politically and how it sold itself as the American game. And so the first half of the book is just kind of setting it up is here's the NFL selling itself as all American, as the national pastime, which, you know, if you look in the 60s, it's somewhere between about 65 and 74. It seems like there's a ton of magazine articles and poll data that people now seem to prefer pro football to baseball. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, so it's somewhere in that period. I don't know if we could say there's an exact time, but it seems like around that mid 60s. That football became the national pastime. And then the second half is looking at how people in politics then, now that football was seen as this major thing that you could use to sell yourself to appeal, then used it in different ways. And so I look specifically at Nixon because Richard Nixon was such a famous football fan. You know, he'd been a football player too, and mm-hmm. then, but really as a fan. And then looking at players as they campaigned and then players in kind of political parties. And then I end up, and actually look at coaches too, which was interesting. And again, obviously, you know, there's books like David Marinus's book on Lombardi that, you know, I wasn't going to top that. He literally interviewed people who like lived next to the Lombardis in Brooklyn in the 20s, mm-hmm. you know, and I wasn't going to do that kind of thing. But, you know, I thought I could kind of maybe shed some light on how people like Vince Lombardi and George Allen were political figures. And then I just end up with Ronald Reagan, who kind of ran this campaign in 1980 that had this weird crossover where Reagan was kind of running as the Gipper, you know, because his most famous role was as George Gipp in this new Rockne film from 40 years before, which is super weird because, you know, Gipp was basically a tramp athlete. You know, he didn't really, you know, he wasn't a student at Notre Dame particularly. He hung around pool halls. Newt Rockne probably made up the whole anecdote when he's dying and tells them, you know, Rock, tell the boys to win one for the Gipper. Mm-hmm. But it didn't matter because it was a great story. And Reagan did the role, you know, he played the role really well. And then, and I looked at all this coverage where people started talking about Reagan as, and the Gipper as interchangeable. So it felt like it was a nice place to end with the sense that the political, like politics and football felt like the same thing. And so that's kind of a semi-brief outline of the story.
Yeah, I mean, talking about the end, I guess, in the beginning of this interview, but I really liked how you even transitioned into Reagan, talking a little bit about Ford and, you know, his playing days at Michigan, which you're probably really familiar with. You know, that was a really nice transition into that also. So I thought that was very well done, as the whole book was. I guess backtracking a little bit, going back earlier in the book, You talked about the whole 1966 narrative of the NFL sending players over to Vietnam as ambassadors, sort of like the first time, and the connection you made with the AFL and NFL's approval of merger by the government, and the whole New Orleans franchise being wrangled out of the deal. If you could tell us a little bit about that, sort of all mixed together, it sounded like.
Sure. Yeah. I think it's actually two stories, one of which was that, you know, pro athletes. So if you look at World War II, I think it's 638 NFL players served in World War II. You know, you think, I mean, obviously football players back then are smaller, right? They're not, you know, offensive linemen, I think now are way too big to serve, you know, in the military. They couldn't march 20 miles. Back in the 60s, obviously everybody's smaller. So your average football player is going to be classified 1A. And the NFL, and this is part of the story of the book, you know, is that in the 40s, it didn't have that currency. Major League Baseball could get its players out, you know, players like Ted Williams and Bob Feller are the exceptions that they go to serve, because you could, if you wanted to in World War II, if you played baseball, you could spend, baseball players were actually highly coveted. You know, you'd be on an Army-based team, and teams like the Great Lakes baseball team were probably better than, you know, the St. Louis Browns during World War II. Actually, the Browns were good in World War II. I take that back. So, you know, they were better than sort of a bad Major League Baseball team. Mm-hmm. Pro football, the NFL didn't have that. You know, the league had to almost fold. Teams kept merging. You know, you had the Eagles and the Steelers merging to form the Steagles, which is an awful name. Mm-hmm. You know, so the thing the NFL wanted,
that's a better name than the year after that when they were with the Cardinals. It was the Card Pits.
Yeah, that's, you think somebody must have said, that's just not, you don't want to name the Carpets. I mean, that's a terrible name too. I don't know. Yeah, I feel like somebody must have been asleep at the wheel on that one. You know, and so what the NFL wanted, number one, was kind of the cultural currency to keep its players out of Vietnam, which they did. You know, only six NFL players served in Vietnam. So one of the things you have is really bad publicity. You know, that people are pointing out there's this huge waiting list for the National Guard, yet the National Guard is full of NFL players. And so one of the things they were doing is they started sending players to Vietnam to kind of brush up the PR, to say, you know, we're doing our part, we're supporting the war effort. And one of the things that was really interesting was that, so I paid a researcher, because it was easier than going to DC. And I found this researcher who'd worked on, and she was great. She'd worked on books by people like Laura Hillenbrand, who wrote Seabiscuit. You know, I thought, okay, that's probably good enough for me. She's worked for Laura Hillenbrand, right? You know, and she found all this great stuff in the USO records, the United Service Organization, that kind of does, used to do the Bob Hope shows. And they had these things called after action reports, which is where they would chaperone the NFL players around and talk about, here's what happened. You know, and so it's really interesting in that the players were not necessarily, you know, the reports are a little critical, that the players complained about having to get up too early. They complained about the living conditions. You know, that they didn't necessarily come across to soldiers as being I don't think it was exactly what the NFL wanted, which is, you know, boy, don't you guys love football? And so it's interesting. You know, I mean, the other thing I found is that it's really clear that from the military brass's perspective, soldiers absolutely wanted to watch football, though. And there's records from people like Creighton Adams who are saying things like, we have to get the NFL on TV over to players in Vietnam. We have to bring films. You know, they flew NFL films to Vietnam. So it's really interesting divergence there, in that there was this kind of, you know, a PR effort to sell the NFL through players, which I don't think was totally successful. And yet the film version was wildly successful. You know, people loved that. They wanted as much NFL as they could get on film. So I think it's kind of a testimony to how good NFL films were. I mean, you know, you probably did too, right? I grew up with all of those, you know, John Facenda narrating, right? You know, and the breath. I just remember the breath, you know, the kind of like the ice bowl game and all those, you know, the breath pluming out of people like that. And I think that just worked for people. And so when, you know, soldiers in Vietnam saw that, it felt like home. So there's sort of two stories. That's one story. The other one is, yeah, the NFL. So the NFL and the AFL had been competing for 5 years, you know, and they were kind of spending each other into oblivion. The most famous being Joe Namath, you know, that the Jets give him this $427,000 contract, a jet green convertible. You know, they outbid, I think the Cardinals drafted him in the NFL, you know, and so the leagues felt like they were going to bid themselves into oblivion. And so they decide to create a merge. They decide to merge, and they're going to have this new thing that they call the Super Game, or, you know, the Big Game. They haven't exactly worked out a name for it right away, right? And then the problem is it runs into antitrust legislation, because it's basically, you know, it's restricting the players' freedom of contract. And one of the things I found was, you know, all these players were really angry about that. I mean, kind of uniformly. And, you know, if you look at so there's testimony in the House, and, you know, all the people from the NFL, Pete Rizzell testifies and say, and he comes in and he's got a list of 30 people saying, this is amazing, this is great. You know, and all these telegrams, I found all these telegrams from players begging, please let us testify. We think this is terrible. And the problem is it runs into a baseball issue, which is the Dodgers famously had left Brooklyn. And so the chairman of the committee, the antitrust committee here, was from Brooklyn. And he was still angry about the Dodgers leaving Brooklyn and highly suspicious of anything like this that seemed like a bunch of owners mistreating players or fans. So he single-handedly held up the merger. And the NFL basically is nervous because, you know, if they can't have the merger, they can't have the Super Bowl in January 67. They're worried about this. And this is the fall of 66. So they need to get this done. And there's this roadblock. This guy's Emanuel Seller basically says, you know, I'm mad about the Dodgers and I'm not going to let this go through until I've really exhausted this. And even then I might not. You know, there's a pile of resolutions in the Senate. One of the great things I found is a letter from Lyndon Johnson's, it's actually Lawrence O'Brien, who later became the commissioner of the NBA, who was kind of his congressional liaison, who said, basically, I was amazed what senators would do to try to get a football team. And so all these senators are basically, you know, they're happily like raising their hands, you know, me, give us a team, give us a team. We will happily push this merger through. But it's stuck in the House. And so they do, and you read the articles, and literally every single one of them calls it an end run. I think that was, you know, that metaphor just seems so obvious to everybody. And so they get a couple of Louisiana congressmen, and that's where I got a lot of these telegrams, was I went to their papers. And Louisiana congressman pretty much said to Roselle, okay, you know, we have a really easy deal for you. Give us a team, and we will sneak the merger around this committee. We'll go another way. And Roselle kind of hemmed and hawed and said, you know, well, we have to think about it. And they said really clearly, give us a team or this is not going to happen. And Roselle knuckled under and said, OK, great. You have a team. You know, we'll help you. We'll basically get the Superdome through so the team will have a place to play. And so what do you know, within the next 3 weeks, you know, and Emanuel Seller is really angry about this. You know, he says this is unfair. It's terrible. It's unconstitutional. You've lost players all these rights. But within 3 weeks, they get the deal done. And so it goes right through the House. It goes through the Senate because the Senate was full of bills. You know, they wanted to pass it. And so by the end of October, I mean, it's, you know, you think about how quickly this happens. And same thing happens with the TV contract in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Is people said, you know, Congress can't get anything done, but they got a football deal done to make sure, you know, football teams can basically to force football teams to show games locally. Mm-hmm. So it's I don't know if it's inspiring exactly, but it's amazing how fast Congress acted when football was involved. And so literally within a month, the deal is done. The merger is okay. It's, you know, even though it violates antitrust laws, Congress decides that's okay. The Saints are now a team and the Super Bowl is going to happen. So it's really an amazing about 4 months in the fall of 1966, which, you know, it's funny. I was born that fall. So, you know, little did I know all these major things were happening right as I was, you know, joining the earth.
That's about the same time I came on too. I was in December of 66. So I'm right there with you. Now, you talked a little bit about Pete Roselle just in what you said there, and you really have him as what sort of a central person because he spanned that whole like 1966 to 74 era that you're talking quite a bit about. And as a person of interest, you quote Jerry Eisenberg, who we just had an author that wrote a book on Eisenberg about a month ago. And he stated that Roselle was a visionary and compared him to P.T. Barnum. And I believe you yourself compared him to Walt Disney and his vision. If you could speak a little bit about Roselle's role in changing the public's perception about the NFL and his part in turning the popularity of the game to, you know, really take an uptick.
Sure. Yeah, I think he really is. It was very forward looking. I mean, you look at his PR campaigns that there's a lot of stories about how when he came on the scene, you know, the NFL basically had been in Pennsylvania because it was close to the previous commissioner's house. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, it was sort of a pokey minor league, still kind of in that Pennsylvania, Ohio area where it had been founded in the 20s, right? It's all those, right, you know, that kind of area that's so central to the early history of football. And Roselle, number one, he moves it to New York City to kind of put it near advertising agencies and TV. He revolutionizes the promotional stuff. It's really interesting. You know, I found some of the promotional sheets they sent out every week. So they suddenly start sending sports writers these sheets that say, here's the points of interest in this game. Here's statistical stuff. It's really modern. And you can actually see this then reflected in some of the sports writing. That, so in that sense, they were literally writing their own newspaper coverage. He, you know, brings NFL films in-house, which I think is huge. That, you know, it was the Sables were famously kind of independent. They love football and just kind of started doing this. And then the NFL acquired them, but then really smartly, I think, let them do their thing. Didn't kind of bring them in and say, you know, here's what you have to do. They let them kind of define the house style. I think politically, you know, he was very savvy in terms of, you know, understanding that people wanted football and people in more places in the country wanted football than had football, you know, and learning the lesson of the AFL is that there were markets that were not served, and that maybe, you know, what you could do is either serve those markets, you know, so they kind of famously do that when they steal the Vikings from the AFL, you know, and kind of realize that that's where they should expand. But also places like Dallas, you know, where the Cowboys drive the Texans out of town. But I think also, you know, under, he sort of had the flexibility to understand that you needed to expand the market. You know, you think of baseball just being so much slower in those ways to kind of expand into new places, to understand how populations were changing in the 50s and 60s. And so I think it's kind of, it's both the political part and the PR part, and understanding that using things like TV and movies and books in new ways could really expand the audience in ways that remain, I think, for kind of people of our generation, you know, you just, I feel like, you know, if you're a football fan, you grew up with NFL films. And that's something that I didn't realize, the degree to which Roselle had been, I don't want to say he guided it, because I think most people would say, you know, Ed and Steve Sable guided them, but he knew enough to let them do their thing as part of a larger strategy. And that's kind of the first half of the book, is understanding how wide that strategy was, that it was kind of political and PR and cultural at the same time, and that he was convincing people that football is great and football is American in all these different ways, and then using that to kind of get things like the merger and the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you say, you know, how he sort of let, you know, Ed Sable and Steve Sable sort of do their own thing. But I think that what their magic was they really didn't focus on what was going on the field, because that's what was being televised during the game. They sort of took you, if you were somebody in the arena, and what was somebody doing in the on the sidelines? What was somebody doing up in the stands? What were the cheerleaders doing? What was a coach saying, or a guy sitting on the sideline? What was he saying? That was the real magic of what NFL films was, and still is. They still do a lot of that, you know, with their mic'd up and segments and taking in the Hard Knocks and that. But you're right. Roselle definitely gave them that freedom to do that, and really helped bring football, not just what was going on in the field, but all aspects of the game, and really brought it into our living rooms. Now, another person you talk quite a bit, because he was definitely a central political figure, and you spoke about him earlier, was Richard Nixon. And he's like smack dab in the middle of the era you write about, that 66 to 74 era. And he was pretty much center stage, because, you know, he was the president then for most of that. Can you tell us about the history and the connection of Nixon to football?
It's a long one. I mean, Nixon, you know, so Nixon went to Whittier College, mm-hmm. where famously he didn't letter in football. But and he actually talked about this a lot, that, you know, he pretty much said, you know, I was terrible at football, but he always credited Wallace Newman, who was his coach, as teaching him. He famously said in his last book, "I learned more standing on the sideline from Coach Newman than I did in all my classes." And Nixon graduated second in his class, so he was a fantastic student. You know, he just always thought of football as really teaching him these virtues of teamwork and learning to win, learning to lose, learning to kind of struggle. And then, so he kind of, you know, he started out that way. And then I think if you look in the late 50s, he starts to, I think it's both, it's like with any president, right? When Barack Obama would do his March Madness picks, you know, partly it was Barack Obama's March Madness picks. And it's partly, here's Barack Obama presenting himself as a relatable person, just like you, who has March Madness picks. And I think Nixon really started that. You know, I think before that, if you look, I mean, there's William Howard Taft, who's the first president to throw out the first pitch on opening day. But I don't think people talked about William Howard Taft as a big baseball fan. You know, that's not part of the stories people tell about Taft. Whereas for Nixon, it really was part of his identity, was being a sports fan in general. And I think particularly being a football fan. And so you see this really in the late 50s. Nixon goes to the American Football Coaches Association, where all the news coverage is, the coaches are astonished by how much football Nixon knows. And he talks about, and then he goes to the Football Writers of America the next year and talks to them. This is, you know, he's still vice president. Obviously, he's going to run for president in 1960. So these aren't, you know, these aren't completely random things. You know, clearly it's part of selling Richard Nixon as a normal guy. The famous line on Nixon is that, you know, Nixon had a hard time doing that, that he was awkward with people, that he wasn't a natural politician. And so, and I have stuff from his campaigns when people talk about this, that his campaign people say, when we talk about Nixon's attraction to sports, people really respond warmly. They think of Nixon, you know, in a good way. And you can find this from journalists, you know, journalists who hated Nixon. I mean, Hunter Thompson you know, who was a gonzo journalist who wrote Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Fear and Loathing on the campaign trail, talks about interviewing Nixon and thinking, you know, this is just some BS. You know, Nixon's in there because they said he should talk about football. And he says, Nixon knows football. I mean, Hunter Thompson was a football fan. And he thought, oh, Nixon's a football fan too. You know, Robert Lipsight, who, you know, is kind of probably the most radical mainstream paper columnist in the 60s and 70s, wrote a thing basically later when Nixon was rehabilitating in the 90s and said, you know, I hated Nixon, but the only time I really felt any attraction to him was when seeing him at a football banquet. And he was talking about football games he remembered and he could recreate them in detail. So this really starts in the late 50s. And then it's a little bit in 1960, you know, he runs for president. He actually announces on the football field at Whittier, where he'd gone to college in Northern California. But I don't think it's a central part, and it's really much bigger in 68. He has teams of athletes out arguing for Nixon. He, in his acceptance speech, he thanks Wallace Newman, again, his coach, and literally, you know, mentions as one of the three or four people who had inspired him to get where he is. And then in 69 and 70, he uses football a ton of different ways to kind of identify his people. You know, I talk about how he, famously, he goes to the Arkansas-Texas game to bestow a national championship. He goes to Kansas State to kick off his sort of midstream campaign in 1970. He brings in a ton of athletes in his photograph with George Allen, the Washington football team coach in 1972, who says, you know, basically Nixon's our quarterback. So he becomes this, you know, sort of famous figure who's a sports fan. The other thing that I just found really interesting was if you look in the 50s and 60s, it's just seen as normal. You know, Nixon's a sports fan. In 1960, one of the comparisons is, you know, look at JFK. JFK is the rich elite. He gets to sit on the 50-yard line. Nixon just sits in the stands like a normal guy. You know, his football career is Nixon tried hard at football. By the time you get to the 70s, when there's this kind of alternative press, and I spent a lot of time looking at the alternative press too, because I don't think that had really, people hadn't sort of looked at that in terms of football. You know, they looked at the Sporting News and Sports Illustrated and the New York Times, et cetera. But they hadn't looked at alternative weeklies, and a lot of that stuff is now on the web. You know, of course, the alternative weeklies hated Nixon, you know, and they basically said, this is, I think there's one from the Berkeley Barber that says, you know, the biggest punk in America, the biggest punk on the football team is now running America. And so, you know, what you suddenly find is people are really disturbed by how much, you know, but basically Nixon hadn't been a success. And there's literally articles where people psychoanalyze Nixon and they look at like the yearbook photo and say, you know, well, Nixon clearly, like, you can see the threat to his manhood in this photograph, you know, and it's like, it's a photograph from 1932 and Nixon's in a football uniform. You know, whenever I read those things, I think like it's a guy in a football uniform. You know, but the article goes on for 20 pages about basically the threat to Nixon's masculinity that is posed. And you can see this here because he didn't make the first string. And so clearly his entire life, he's overcompensating. So it's interesting that I think it moved from, you know, Nixon is a football fan, which is totally normal, to, oh my God, Nixon's a psychopath. And being a football fan explains why he's a psychopath, because only a psychopath would be the kind of football fan he is, because he's a failed athlete. So it's just, it's, you know, and I thought that's kind of, it's just interestingly weird in this way, because the other thing is that, you know, when you look at the, especially the 68 and 72 elections, all of the candidates were football fans. You know, George McGovern, who was a huge lefty and is seen as probably the most left-wing candidate ever, was a huge football fan. Hubert Humphrey was a huge football fan. But somehow the only person that got talked about in these terms was, well, Nixon's a football fan, and this proves Nixon's a psycho. You know, even though literally, you know, a lot of the criticisms of football, people like George McGovern said, that's garbage. Football's great, you know, but somehow nobody wrote articles that said, oh my God, George McGovern is a fascist because he likes football. It was just, so I was kind of interested in just the weirdness of the discussion around Nixon in a way that didn't apply to anyone else, even though they were all, I mean, literally Hubert Humphrey went on the road with 3/4 of the Purple Pete Litter's defensive line. You know, he went on the road with these guys. You know, it's interesting. I should have maybe seen if Alan Page would have talked to me just to see, because he became a judge. He was a Hall of Fame defensive end for the Vikings and then is now a judge. And I thought, you know, and there's photographs, in, I think, in the book of Humphrey with Alan Page. And they're just standing there in a publicity photo, you know, talking, and they're in uniform, you know, and yet nobody says, wow, you know, Hubert Humphrey, man, that guy was weird because he was really into football. So I think the standard line on Nixon for years was, you know, Nixon's weird and psychotic, and football is kind of the key to that. And so I wanted to kind of, I ended up finding out that felt really weird and unfair.
But of course, one of Nixon's great things that he did concerned football, getting the law passed to sort of diminish the blackouts that were happening. And you talk a little bit about that in your book too.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fun story because I think the famous story is Nixon basically wanted to watch the Redskins in Florida, he could have in Florida, but I think it was more locally. He couldn't because they were blacked out. I think the idea was that TV would kill local attendance. And then when there was some noises made, again, this is like 1973, if I'm right, 73 or 74, there was this big push. Yeah. And it got done really quickly in Congress that Nixon kind of pushed for this law that said, let's make it, you know, if the game is sold out, then you can televise it locally rather than just being, we're going to have this blanket refusal to let people watch football locally. And I think that's, you know, one of the things I think you're interested in thinking about is what's the kind of major political legacy in football long-term. And I think, and I was thinking about it, and I think that's really it, is this, you know, you just think about all these exploding, the Amazon TV contracts, you know, the ESPN contract, the Fox contracts, that just every time, you know, it's some multiplier of revenue that the NFL signs a new, more expansive contract. And it really feels like that was so crucial, is realizing that TV wasn't the enemy. You know, the TV, and I think, you know, Roselle, I don't say he got dragged kicking and screaming into that, but I think he had to be nudged into it a little bit. And I think, you know, the owners had to be nudged into that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think you had, you even mentioned in the book, the sort of the AFL had their ABC contract that sort of came out first before the NFL really had a big contract with, I can't remember if it was CBS or NBC, but they sort of got that ball rolling. The NFL looked at it and said, hey, they're making a lot of money here. And I think that from what you were saying, that's sort of convinced Roselle to, hey, this is a moneymaker. And I just love the illustration. And I think you mentioned a couple times in the book, at least, where you say, you know, television is perfect for football and football is perfect for television. I just think that's so eloquently said and well represented in your book.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I mean, I definitely, it still feels like it's kind of, I mean, when I had jobs in grad school, I would, you know, I had to grade papers and stuff. And I would literally, the great thing about moving to California was that, you know, your football day starts at 9 a.m. You know, that on the East Coast, it's, you know, I mean, when I was kind of in high school living in New York, you know, you didn't have the full ESPN pregame, or at least we didn't have ESPN. I didn't watch ESPN in like 1983. But by the time, you know, it's the late 80s, you know, you could watch the pregame starting 9 a.m. Then you have the early game, which starts at 10 a.m., then the late game at 1 p.m., then the Sunday night football game. So I could pretty much spend the entire day watching football and football commentary and then highlights, mm-hmm. you know, and allegedly getting work done and mostly not getting work done. You know, and so I just think about, yeah, how well it translates to television in a way that, you know, I mean, I prefer going to live baseball games, I think, to watching baseball on TV. Whereas when I've been to, I mean, college football, I'd say is different because of the feeling of being in the crowd. But the pro football games I've been to, I kind of felt like, you know, because I didn't have this deep sense of fan attachment in the way I did at college games, I kind of would have rather watched it on TV.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it becomes even more and more in today's world. I mean, not just forget about COVID, but, you know, 2019 season, it was this fan experience is actually better at your home with the quality of the televisions and the camera work and, you know, the, you know, whatever they got out now, 4D or whatever is going on now.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just amazing the picture you get. And it's better than looking at it from, you know, sometimes a 75 yards away when you're sitting in the stands. I'm in Erie, Pennsylvania. So we're 100 miles from Buffalo, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh. We're right in the middle of that triangle. And the Buffalo Bills had a quarterback, Jack Kemp, who played on multiple teams in the NFL. But you talk quite a bit about Jack Kemp going right out of the NFL and AFL and into politics. And I sat there and I said, wow, I was always thinking it was a few years apart between there, but you're right. It's like months after he was done. Last season he played 11 of 14 games in 1969. And then you have him in March of 1970 running for the U.S. Congress in the 39th district. If you could talk a little bit about Jack Kemp and his role in this whole political NFL thing.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting story because it was, I think he's probably the most direct example. I mean, if you look at in the late 60s in general, there's a ton of these kinds of candidates that, that political, one of the things I sort of got into was all these political consultants, number one, started to compare their work to football. And a lot of them would literally keep a won and lost record, you know, and then kind of keep drawing this analogy. And then specifically, people talked about, yeah, how football players would make great politicians. You know, Sam, so in the same election, Sam Huff ran, did very poorly, lost, never ran again, and kind of talked about it embarrassedly. But it basically made Kemp's second career, and he spent the next 25 years in Washington. And I think it was a fascinating story because it's really clear. So I had, again, this researcher I talked to, Peggy Ann Brown, I should give you her name. She's, if you're listening out there and you're working on something, she's a great resource in DC. And she went to, look at the Kemp papers. And so I could see, you know, campaign brochures, and there's a whole page from, there's a whole, you know, basically memo from consultants. There's a big article in Sports Illustrated that followed his campaign. And it's really clear that, you know, Kemp had been political since the early 60s. So Herb Klein, who was kind of Nixon's speechwriter and one of his big, he was sort of his public face originally when he elected in 1968, Herb Klein saw something in Kemp. And so they gave him a column in the San Diego Union in the early 60s. So I went back and read Kemp's columns. So clearly, you know, Kemp had been, he was a conservative Republican kind of from the early 60s. And they started grooming him and saying, you know, this guy's good looking, he's photogenic, and he's famous. So if we could run him in Buffalo, we're pretty sure he could win. And, you know, and so it's an interesting case because I think the kind of general idea, there's a bunch of these campaigns where you would try to find someone who is locally, I mean, Tommy Tuberville, right, just got elected mm-hmm. in Alabama, you know, from being Auburn's coach. So, or, you know, Tom Osborne was elected. I think J.C. Watts in Oklahoma had been Oklahoma's quarterback. Steve Largent in Washington. You know, there's a lot of these candidates. But Kemp is probably the most long-lived one, I think, in terms of, and it really is that the movement is, you know, he was a quarterback, and there's a lot of this, you know, I went back and read his speeches, you know, and he clearly, I think, was able to use football as the thing that made him a compelling candidate. You know, that it wasn't, and there's actually stories from the Buffalo papers about fans booing him in places like Buffalo because of his politics, which I think is really interesting. You know, that they kind of knew what Kemp stood for because he was making speeches already, you know, in 66, 67, 68, even before he ran, and people knew what Jack Kemp stood for. And they didn't necessarily, you know, I think there's a big working class population in Buffalo, and Kemp was not necessarily seen as the triumph of the working man. You know, he wasn't seen as that kind of candidate. So I think it was a fascinating career because he's the most successful athlete into politician. And I think the other thing that's really interesting is that as a Republican, you know, he famously said, you know, I've showered with more black men than most Republicans know. And he was always really famous for, you know, his teammates talk about this as really for his egalitarianism, and that the Republican Party, you know, there was a big perception, I think, in the 70s and 80s that the Republican Party was running on race as an issue with the so-called Southern strategy. And Nixon himself, you know, kind of pioneered this in 68. And so Kemp was really an exception in the sense that he always said his football experience had made him much more comfortable with a diverse set of people and viewpoints. And there's even jokes from the time he's in Buffalo that I think Cookie Gilchrist, who was this very outspoken running back, that there were jokes that maybe Kemp was passing so much because he didn't want to hand off to Cookie Gilchrist because they differed politically. There's literally jokes people are making in, there's a book I have that it's called, it's this book by the sports writer Murray Olderman called The Pro Quarterback from, I think, 1966, maybe 67. And he's got this joke right in that book about, you know, Kemp's politics are sort of dictating his play calls. So I think it's a fascinating story. And I think he's also kind of different in a way from a lot of other politicians in the sense that they really, you know, for them, it kind of was football was the thing that sold them. And what Trent Dilfer ran too, right?
Right. Right.
And I'm trying to think of somebody else who actually was, I can't remember who was a former Michigan lineman who also, John Runyon got elected. I think former Eagle, right?
great. And you had Lynn Swann that ran. He didn't win, but he was running just a couple years ago. I forget, for a state senate or something he was running for. So,
I think Kemp is interesting because he's the most successful of all the kind of athlete candidates.
Hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting. Probably it doesn't hurt to have your name already be famous too when you're on a ballot for those undecided voters. You know, go in there and say, "Oh, I recognize this name. This is one I'll pick." It's just human nature to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know anything, so that doesn't hurt either. But yeah, very very interesting that you had on there. Now, something that really caught my eye again, and this is sort of off topic a little bit, but sort of on topic, is you had an excerpt about the NFL's Bicentennial Essay Contest. Now, if you could speak a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was one of those things I just kind of wanted to spend so much more time on it. I actually found the woman who won it and I interviewed her, and it just didn't really fit in the book, unfortunately. But it's a great story that they wanted to for the Bicentennial kind of be part of the whole celebrations. And they figured, what if we have this contest where kids can write in and talk about what football means? And, you know, it kind of got made fun of in the press, but seems to have still done pretty well. And they just ended up with, you know, and I don't think, I mean, the winning essay is actually not bad, but it really testifies, what I think it testifies to is how much the kind of promo stuff we were talking about before had really seeped into the culture. That, you know, the people who were in were talking about football as democracy, football as capitalism in action, you know, kind of all the things the NFL wanted people to associate the NFL with. The essays then played back to them and said, you know, this is why football is so American. You know, I think it's, I mean, to me, what's just so interesting is you think about baseball, right? You know, baseball had sort of famously been the national pastime. It got this, you know, I mean, you know, the antitrust case, right, from the 20s, when the Supreme Court pretty much says, well, we know baseball's a business, but we don't want to think about it that way, so it's not. And then, you know, in Flood versus Kuhn in 72, when Curt Flood had sued for free agency, the decision, I don't know if you've read the decision, it's crazy. It literally starts with, I think it's William Brennan wrote the decision. He lists all of his famous favorite baseball players from when he was a kid for like 2 pages. You know, it's just baseball is awesome. I love baseball. Therefore, Curt Flood can't be a free agent. You know, and so baseball always had this kind of romantic aura. I don't think, you know, that's going to work for football. And so what football had was this argument that football is teamwork. Football is striving hard. Football is about getting up again after getting knocked down. And football is, you know, Kemp especially said this a lot, just to go back to Jack Kemp. He said it was capitalism in action because, you know, you basically had to do the thing that worked. And that's what, you know, it was, they weren't going to give you any opportunities. You had 4 downs to go 10 yards every single time. It was always the same. Everybody was treated fairly. And so it was, what I liked about the essay contest was you could see that that's what people were saying. So it was a neat way to find out that the NFL clearly had succeeded and that the youth of America in 1976 had bought what the NFL was selling.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a crazy thing because you have a picture of one of the ads here. And the actual question is the NFL's role in American history. That's what you had to write the essay on. This is for ages 14 to 18. I don't know if I'm 14 to 18. I'm connecting the NFL to any part of American history at that point in my life. So it's just really interesting. That's the question that they chose.
Yeah. And I think it's because it's the Bicentennial. You know, they wanted a kind of hook there. And I wasn't able to find out too much about the, like how that gestated and if they tried for something a little easier, you know, and then the Bicentennial, because I read the Bicentennial records and it seems like the NFL just came to them and said, we have this thing. And the Bicentennial people pretty much said, well, okay. You know, they didn't, it was more kind of, this sounds like a good idea. Sure. Why not? You know, it really came from the NFL rather than the Bicentennial people. And there were certainly a lot of essays, you know, a lot of journalists made fun of it. And did this kind of, you know, well, the Puritans didn't like football, but fortunately now we can watch football on TV. So I think they had kind of the reaction you did, which is, I don't know what you're supposed to say here, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. You know, but I think, I mean, and that's in some way, I think, you know, what you're pointing out is that the book is trying to say, here's what the NFL's connection to American history is, at least in that period, mm-hmm. you know, in a way that is much longer than, you know, the 500-word essay they were letting 14-year-olds write.
Well, you really piqued my curiosity now, because I was going to ask you this, but now that you said you talked to the woman that won the contest, what was her essay about, and how did it pass the teacher test?
Yeah, it was a pretty good essay. I mean, yeah, I think, you know, it was basically saying it's complex and it requires an appreciation of complexity, and it requires you to accept winning and losing and to work in this organized way as a team. What's actually really interesting is that I think Alan Nevins was this famous, he wrote these sort of big popular books on American history. And he had said something like, there's nothing to be learned from this, because this one journalist named David Israel for the Washington Star, you know, kind of had the same reaction you did. And he said, well, I'm just going to go ask some historians, you know, what do you guys think football is? And a bunch of them said things like, that's a stupid question. You know, football has no reflection in American history. And so she kind of responded. So the funny thing was, she responded to Alan Nevins and then ended up actually taking a class from him in college later on, which I thought was funny that she got into Williams where he taught, you know, and they never kind of had a moment where she said, you know, I wrote this essay that kind of disagreed with you, where I do think football shows the importance of success and teamwork. You know, you know, as we talked about before, kind of with NFL films, right? The NFL films showed you what's off the field and what's on the field. You know, the essays tended to be pretty much, the other essays were not good. The ones that were second and third place, I just thought that's, you know, it felt like some like 12-year-old kid sort of saying football is awesome. You know, and hers was pretty much about how what's on the field is very American in terms of all those virtues of America. You know, I wouldn't expect a 14-year-old to kind of know or even have access to in 76, you know, the kind of internal stuff about right. this that, you know, right. is you have to go do archival research, which, you know, she was, the funny thing is she went to T.C. Williams, which is the famous school in Remember the Titans.
Oh, okay.
So we ended up having this conversation kind of about that, where that film has become, it's kind of this official thing they show to students every year, apparently, because it's now part of the mythology of T.C. Williams as being, you know, here's what we did in integration and here's how this story dramatizes that. So it was a neat kind of, you know, and the story ended up having dimensions I hadn't expected, which I thought were surprising. Yeah,
that's tied up real nicely with a bow on it for it.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think what a great PR thing for the NFL that essay turned out to be. Then they probably should have capitalized more on that, especially you have a young lady, 14 to 18 in the 1970s, that's winning their contest and really has the best essay. It wasn't just because she was a young lady. You know, that's tremendous.
Yeah, it's a good point. I didn't get the sense that they did a lot with, you know, kind of football appeals to women, which maybe they could have made more of. I mean, she got to go to the Super Bowl, you know, and meet Pete Rozelle. So I think from her perspective, it was pretty fun. But you're right, they didn't really, I think probably because there was so much mockery of it that, you know, in a way that if you read, so I you know, one of the things I found was when you found these reviews of things like, you know, the first NFL films releases, film critics love them. You know, it's now in the Library of Congress next to Citizen Kane. You know, so it's literally become a piece of literally classic film lore in a way that I think Rozelle probably knew when to cut his losses too. And that, you know, this contest was not going to be something they were going to do annually. I mean, they sort of do in a sense that if you read those, I ended up reading a whole book of Super Bowl essays, you know, just in the Super Bowl program, and they got George McGovern, they've gotten all sorts of thinkers there. So maybe they kind of have a more elevated version, you know, in the Super Bowl program. But I don't, you know, it was one of these things that was a really hard book to get. So I don't get the sense that it's, you know, it's not a thing that kind of in the popular consciousness, people are like, wow, I wonder what's in the Super Bowl program for this year. I wonder what it's saying about football. You know, it's clearly never resonated in any broader sense. As you know, I said, literally, I had to interlibrary loan it from my library because our public library didn't have it. I think, you know, nobody in kind of California had it. So I had to get it from three states away. So it kind of suggests, you know, nobody is like, well, this book is a really important book to have in our collection because everyone's going to want to know, you know, what's the kind of official essay in this year's Super Bowl program. So yeah, it feels like they kind of just kept it up a little bit, but, you know, not in any really, you know, not in the way that you can see all the things on TV.
Right. I mean, they really tapped into a demographic I don't think they were expecting, or one wouldn't expect. And
yeah,
they really tapped into that. Well, okay. We'll talk a little bit more on where people get your book in a second, but I want to follow up with a question. Do you have anything coming up in the near future, anything regarding sports history or football history in general that people can look forward to from you?
I mean, I have a couple of essays coming out in academic collections, which that may strain the definition of looking forward to. But I basically just, I think I'm pretty much done with one on Nixon as a fan, which was neat just to kind of go back and reread that and see, you know, what he talked about and how fluidly he did it and all the coverage. And actually I have one I have to finish on Jack Kemp and how, I mean, I wrote 30 pages on Jack Kemp and Sam Huff, and at the press, they said, nobody really wants that much. So I had to, you know, condense it to 5 pages, which was a little, you know, so I'm sort of sad. So it'll be nice to kind of spin out, especially more on Kemp in San Diego and kind of how San Diego, because it's a collection that we're working on that I'm part of about Sunbelt sports. So it's kind of generally how sports expanded, you know, to that area of the country and kind of a whole variety of, you know, auto racing and all kinds of different things. And so that's what I'm working on. I mean, personally, I'm trying to get going on my next book, which is actually putting the 69 Mets in context of their year. So I was spending all this time reading newspapers and just kind of trying to understand, you know, how, because obviously everybody knows the story, right? Is, you know, the Mets, everybody thought they're going to be terrible. They were a miracle team. They won the pennant and they reunited in New York City. You know, and you read the newspapers at the time and, oh my God, the fragmentation in New York City. You know, just in January and February, the city feels like it's falling apart and people hate each other. And there's people firebombing synagogues. There's big riots over exhibits at museums. There's kids boycotting schools, people boycotting teachers. You know, there's clearly this moment of fragmentation. So I think I'm kind of, I wouldn't say that's coming out soon, but I'm working on it.
Okay. Well, that's definitely something to look forward to, because I know we have quite a bit of folks in the New York City area that love their Mets and would enjoy a book like that. So that's great. Now, where can we find you, this book we were talking about, The Pigskin Nation and How the NFL Remade American Politics? Where can people go to purchase this?
I mean, it's on Amazon. It's on all, you know, the major bookstores. You could, I feel like I should say buy local, you know, so if you can go to your local bookstore, they can order it for you too. Obviously I know Amazon's easier, but yeah. So I think any bookstore, it's probably, you know, it came out a couple of years ago. So I don't know if it's necessarily on the shelf, but you know, you can order it through them, which I would love and appreciate. And I'm happy if anyone wants me to sign it, send it to me and I'll happily sign it for you.
Oh, okay. Make sure we put a point of contact. If you need to get a hold of Jesse, just email us at pigskindispatch@gmail.com and we'll get your information to Jesse and get in contact with you. Now, Jesse, do you have any social media that you want to put out there in case people want to follow you on social?
I have a Twitter account, but I don't really use Twitter. So I'd say I have a website for the book. That's just my name, jessebarrett.com.
Okay.
That's basically it. I haven't been doing a lot of social media just because it feels exhausting. I probably should be. I mean, I follow people like Jeff Perlman on social media, you know, who's a prolific writer, and he's constantly doing stuff. And I just admire the energy. I think I just don't, you know, I don't have that kind of energy. So yeah, the website's probably the easiest thing.
Okay. We'll put a link to that on the show notes of this podcast. So listeners out there, if you want to, instead of writing it down, just look at that link and it'll take you right to Jesse's website and you can check it out. And I guess I want to mention that I believe you also can buy your book, the University of Illinois Publishing, who is your publisher that got us this connection with Jesse today. So yeah, we want to make sure that you can go through them also to get the book.
And they have, sales fairly often too, so you can probably get it for something off too, which, because I think they're all, you know, they're always trying to sell books, so it's worth checking there just to see if they're having sale.
Yeah, and they're very easy to work with too, folks, so they're very communicative there, so we really appreciate them. Jesse, you have anything last things to say about the book or anything else? And we really appreciate.
No, this is great. Thank you. I mean, I've done a bunch of these, so I really, you've had me think about things I haven't thought about before, which is a testimony to you, so thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. And we really appreciate your time. And we want everybody to make sure you go out there and get this book, Pigskin Nation, How the NFL Remade American Politics, Jesse Barrett. Jesse, thank you once again for joining us on the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch. And we'll hope to get some more sales of your book. And we look forward to that Mets book.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
The 2021 Professional Football Researchers Association Convention will be held at the Gold Jacket Lounge at the Pro Football Hall of Fame during the final weekend of June. Convention speakers will celebrate the 100th anniversary of the founding of the NFL. The fee for the convention is $50 for members and $100 for non-members. The fee includes admission to the convention and Pro Football Hall of Fame, meals on Friday evening and Saturday afternoon, and free parking. All convention activities are subject to COVID-19 protocols. For more details, click on the 2021 PFRA convention link at profootballresearchers.org.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.